So today we're going to talk about illiquid assets, and we're going to cover a number of different areas. We're going to focus on the issues to do with asset valuations for illiquid assets, some liquidity issues, dealing with transaction costs, fees and disclosures, and I think the most important thing is what does it mean for actuaries. We're hoping to get through the presentation in about half the time because we've got a number of discussion points that we want to talk about, and we really like to invite questions from the floor. If you have any urgent question during the presentation, feel free to speak up. Otherwise, save it for the discussion at the end. So what are we actually talking about today? Illiquid assets actually form a large part of the investable asset universe. A lot of people, especially when it comes to their own superannuation, keep thinking about equities and bonds. But if you look at the broader spectrum, there's a lot of investments out there in commercial property, infrastructure, private equity, and non-exchange traded derivatives. So there's a large universe out there. And so what we're interested in is how do you get into that universe? Well, traditionally, illiquid assets were purchased directly as part of maybe a traditional portfolio by a life company or an investment company. Over the last few decades, we've seen listed trusts become quite popular. And in particular, if you think about listed property trusts here as an analogy or as an example, listed property trusts, the investors transact between themselves and there's a fixed number of securities on issue. So that means if I go to the market and I buy a unit in GPT or Westfield, I'm buying it off someone else. And in doing so, the market forces determine the price of that transaction. Unitized trusts, on the other hand, investors actually, when they buy and sell, they're actually adding or subtracting to the unit or the pool of units on issue. So it's fundamentally different. And in doing so, there's no market-decided exchange rate, and in fact, the price is actually determined by the investment manager. So two quite different worlds that we're looking at here. But when it comes to superannuation, and we all know how important superannuation is, there's been a massive drive into sector-specific unitized funds, and I guess because of diversification and other requirements, this has seen that money flowing into illiquid assets. It goes through two main avenues. One is property securities funds, and these are unitized funds that invest in property securities, such as LPTs. And then you have direct property or infrastructure funds, and these are unitized funds where the asset they hold is not a listed security, but is actually the property or the infrastructure asset itself. And also because it's superannuation, we're really seeing a drive through member choice and portability for the need of ready liquidity. And I guess what we're asking today is there a contradiction between the apparent market need for ready liquidity and the illiquid nature of the underlying assets? We're going to focus today on unitized direct property funds because these are the most popular. There's obviously other unitized illiquids around, especially infrastructure funds. There's a lot of parallels. Not everything will apply to both, but unless we say otherwise, we're going to be focusing on direct property funds. It's a large industry. There's $90 billion at the moment in funds under management. A lot of this is wholesale, but a lot of it's also retail with sort of mums and dads directly investing. And that direct market has increased from $1.5 billion just over a decade ago to $30 billion today. And some of these individual funds can be up to $3 billion in one fund themselves. We can see some of the key players here, and some of these are multi-managers that invest in other asset classes as well, your Macquaries and Challengers, but there's a lot of specialist players in this market as well. And you also see the companies like Centro and MFS in there as well, specialist unlisted, unitised direct property managers. And up until recently, almost all of these could be accessed, all the retail ones could be accessed by the mainstream retail platforms. This is changing since Centro and MFS have come into trouble. But up until that point, you could go through one of the headline investment platforms and get straight into these products with your own money. So as I said earlier, we're going to cover a couple of the key issues, the asset valuations and illiquidity, potential inequities and also some of the consumer issues. Okay, here we have a real situation, and what we've got here is the index is the legend is a bit small, but the red line is a unitised direct property fund, and the green line is a proxy index for the property market. Now, the property market, every property is different, and it's hard to get an index that would adequately represent every property. But in this case, I think we actually used I think it was the LPT market, which has some elements of equity in its movement. But in any case, over this period, there was a strong upsurge in property values, and that was also reflected in unlisted indexes like the Mercer Direct Property Index. Over that same period, the Direct Property Fund maintained a relatively level unit price. You can see that there's small variations over the course of the, I think this was a 6-month period, and those variations are just due to cash flows and things, rental income anomalies. But when you get to the sort of the end point here, you've got a large divergence between what the unit price has done for the last 6 months and what the market has done for the last 6 months. So I'm not sure if anyone can hazard a guess as to what happens at the end of the year here. But the unit price jumps quite substantially. And the underlying reason for this is due to the infrequent valuations of the underlying properties. And so obviously over that 6-month period, there was actually no revaluations of the property in the portfolio. And in normal circumstances, that may not be such an issue. But in a hot market, you sort of end up with this pent up increases that only reveal themselves when you actually perform the valuation. Obviously, if you've got sophisticated investors out there, they're watching the market, they're watching the unit prices. Often retirees have nothing better to do and spend all day on their platforms having a look what's happening. And in this particular instance, there was actually quite a large upsurge or uplift in applications in the couple of weeks prior to the year end. And so I think that's a fairly clear example of people recognising that there's a valuation issue here, realising that if they get in, they can probably have the opportunity to make a 20% gain in just a couple of weeks. And so we've called that inequity, but in fact, it's probably what we call exploitation of the price or arbitrage, which is a term that's often used in the unit pricing industry for investors, I guess, unfairly taking advantage of discrepancies in pricing. It's a bit different to the arbitrage that we talk about in the investment markets world, where arbitrage is a good thing and brings market forces, acts as market forces. In the unitised space, as we talked about before, there is no market. The market is the manager. So arbitrage directly impacts between investors. Now, this is just a made-up example. And what we have here is the reverse situation, where the market is rapidly falling. And this is a bit worse or a bit more concerning than the market increasing. And the reason is that when there's sharp falls in the property market and the unit prices lag behind the realistic asset values of the properties themselves, you end up with this overvaluation effect, and that encourages people to rapidly withdraw. People want to get out. They know the price hasn't moved. They know the market's going down. And as people leave the fund, and usually these funds are heavily geared as well, you end up with this rapid spiral where outflows force fire sale of assets. And as those assets are sold at not only below their carrying value, they're sometimes even sold below what would be a realistic market value because they have to be sold that quickly, you end up with a situation that remaining investors end up wearing significant losses. And this situation has happened before, and Tim described it earlier, in the early 90s. And it equally leads to these inequity and arbitrage that we talked about. But worse than that, it leads to liquidity issues and in fact, can lead to market instability. So as far as we're concerned, this situation and this situation result from the same thing. It's just infrequent asset valuations with frequent transactional capability, but they lead to different outcomes, one much more severe than the other. So if we have a look at some of the case studies, Tim referred to the property market crash in the early 90s. This led to major liquidity problems for some of these managers, so much so that the corporation's law was actually amended at the time to require the trustee, which is obviously now the RE, to consider where withdrawals would have, and we've got the quote here, whether withdrawals would have a material adverse effect on the value of the remaining units in the trust. So this was a specific legal provision put in to require direct property funds, and it only applies to direct property funds, doesn't apply to equity funds and other funds, but it requires them before processing any withdrawal to consider the impact on the other investors in the trust. And so if an organisation actually breached this, they'd be in breach of the corporation's law. Moving on to the more recent times, we've got the example that we saw earlier where there was a property boom up till 2007. A lot of funds were undervalued, and there was arbitrage going on with investors taking advantage of the lag in valuations. And more recently, with the credit crunch, we've seen unsustainable levels of gearing lead to liquidity issues in some of these funds. Investors want to get their money out, and because of the requirements of the corpse law, these funds have to suspend redemptions. So in the case of organisations like Centro, as investors started to ask for their money back out of the unlisted trusts, fairly quickly the manager had to suspend redemptions to make sure they didn't breach the corpse law. So I guess with three significant examples of inequities and problems in this market over the last two decades, I guess we're asking, is giving in transactional capability and daily transactional, weekly transactional capability to investors on illiquid assets a wise thing to do? What does the regulator say about this? On top of the provisions in the corporations law which cover a downturn, the ASIC-APRA unit pricing guide has a number of quotes in it which I think are applicable in this situation. It says unit prices, in principle, unit prices should only be struck with the same frequency that assets values are determined. So if you've got a property fund and you're valuing your assets annually, then I guess if you're allowing people to transact weekly, how are you satisfying that principle? And equally, if you are valuing assets infrequently, say daily or weekly, and you shouldn't strike a price in between unless there's a reasonable basis for estimating the price. So we're not saying that these managers should be commissioning an independent valuation of the whole portfolio every week. I'm sure the valuation the valuation experts would love that. But what we're saying is that if you are allowing transactions to happen, then you've got to have a reasonable estimate of what the price would be, rather than just carrying the last valuation for the full 12 months. In a speech about the unit pricing guide a year after it was released, David Rush actually said that APRA have particular concern about the use of frequent unit pricing, which can be incompatible with significant investments in unitised and not frequently valued assets. So obviously the regulator is aware of this, not only through their good practice guide, but in follow-up presentations. What's the industry response to this? One common response that we've seen in the market is rolling valuations. So rather than valuing all your assets on the 31st of December each year, what you do is you revalue some of the assets every quarter to smooth out the unit prices. And this is a common thing in the industry. Often valuations are occurred on a rolling quarterly basis. So you'd revalue 25% of your assets in January, 25% in April. But if you have a rapidly moving market, you can see here we've got a little graph. The vertical axis is the unit price, or the value of the properties, and the horizontal axis is the year. In a period where the market is falling quite rapidly, as we just talked about earlier, you end up with this stepped unit price. You still end up with a portion of overvaluation. Now, obviously it's not as bad as a situation as if you held the unit price constant for the whole year and rapidly and revalued the whole portfolio on the 31st of December. But you can see in a rapidly moving market, rolling the valuations doesn't remove all the risk. And so we see this as going part of the way, but it's not the solution. Okay, we're going to move on now to some of the consumer issues in regards to these products, and then we'll finish off with some discussion. I'll introduce Annie Lau.
Thanks, Wade. So the next issue we'd like to address here is about transaction cost. So just to refresh our memory, the purpose of allowing for transaction costs in unit prices is to ensure that the costs incurred for processing the applications and redemptions are borne by the transacting investor and not the remaining investors in the fund. So in the case of an illiquid asset, as we all know, buying and selling airports and buildings are very expensive. It incurs high levels of transaction costs such as stamp duty and settlement costs. So how are these actually allowed for in unit prices? There are two common market methods, capitalise and buy-sell spreads. Capitalising the purchase costs up front and amortising it over a period of time is a concept that most of us are very familiar with. It's equivalent to the DAC and the DOC in life insurance. Its overall impact on the fund is slightly lower performance returns since the cost of amortisation is offset against the actual asset returns. However, its main problem lies in that it is actually not equitable to all investors, as it allocates the greatest cost to early investors and with later investors not paying their fair share of the costs. So for a closed-ended fund, this may be appropriate. But for an open fund, where investors are free to transact in and out, this is inequitable to early investors who will bear the brunt of the costs. The second method is the buy-sell spread, which is commonly used in other unitized trust for mainstream asset classes such as equities. It results in a better outcome in terms of equity since as each investor pays an equal share of the transaction costs. However, as the transaction costs for acquiring and disposing properties are very high, an equitable and appropriate spread based on actual costs incurred would be over 5% to even to 10% on a geared product. So this makes the product not marketable. Hence, both methods have their pros and cons, but unfortunately, there's actually no perfect solution in this case. And for these products to be competitive in the marketplace, investor equity has probably taken a back seat to marketability. Another key area for consideration is the product fees for these unitised illiquid assets. When investing in a unitised fund, we're used to seeing fees and paying for fees for transaction fees such as contribution and termination fees, as well as the ongoing investment fees that we pay to the investment managers for their services. And sometimes we might even pay the performance fees for their outperformance in a market. But what you may not have seen before are these additional fees. These are found in unitised direct property trusts. These are fees payable directly to the manager on top of the normal fees and regular expenses incurred, which are already reimbursed back to the managers. So, for example, the asset acquisition fee is the fee payable directly to the manager when a new asset is acquired for the fund. This is a lump sum fee payable on top of the acquisition incurred costs, such as due diligence, legal and accounting costs, already reimbursed. It's meant to compensate the manager for their time spent on researching and identifying the asset. Similarly, the asset disposal fees is the fee payable directly to the manager when the asset is sold off the fund. Now, in other institutions, these would generally be covered as part of the investment management fees that you already pay. But for these particular direct property trusts, additional fees are added on top. So the important thing to note here is that these are all additional fees payable directly to the manager and are fees payable on top of incurred expenses which are already reimbursed by the funds, as well as the regular fees which we are familiar with. So in aggregate, these property trust managers probably are collecting slightly higher fees than other traditional unit trusts. But that's actually not the real problem. The problem lies in the actual disclosure of these fees. Because what you see in the PDS disclosures is something like this. These particular levels of fees. In fact, these fees might even look more attractive than other investment products. But in reality, these additional fees are actually disclosed in the fine print of the PDSs. I mean, the purpose of disclosure templates is for comparability and simplicity. That is, to allow simple comparison across products from different institutions and prevent hidden costs, as well as provide an easily understood format for investors. The use of fees disclosed in fine print only manipulates disclosures to hide the true costs. So these property managers have created an uneven playing field for all other investment managers. But we'd actually like to take this opportunity to acknowledge the fact that property managers' contribution to innovation in financial markets. It takes a creative mind to come up with some of these fees. So, as actuaries, what does this actually mean for us? For the valuation actuaries out there, the next time you receive the unit prices for these trusts, can you actually trust their valuations, particularly when assets are valued so infrequently? When these assets are suspended, for example, MFS, what value do you place on these securities? The investment actuaries out there, hopefully we've identified a couple of things that you'll keep an eye on the next time you're choosing your investments. For product actuaries, as we know, the playing field is not equal anymore, particularly in relation to disclosures. So how can you try and level this playing field? And also, by offering these products on your platforms, what issue would you be exposing your investors to, and what obligations do you have to your investors for them to understand these key considerations? And even the Institute has issued a submission to ASIC highlighting their concerns, particularly around consumer issues, and encouraging the need for actuarial involvement in these areas, including disclosure. In addition, whilst the FinCorp BridgeCorp incidents have damaged the financial industry reputations, the recent experiences with Centro and MFS could be damaging the super funds, which will impact our everyday investors, the mums and dads. So should we not be getting involved in this area? That actually concludes the formal part of the presentation. I'll hand over back to Tim for some discussion.
Thank you, Annie. We'll now open the discussion to the floor. It'll be necessary for you to come to the lectern to speak, to raise questions or to discuss any points you want to discuss. There are some thought starters here, but we can park them. We'll start with whatever everyone wants to raise. When you come to the lectern, please give us your name so that the discussion is recorded and everyone who plays it back knows who's asked what questions or raised what points. So now invite discussion from the floor. Mike.
Mike Barker. Well, certainly I welcome this paper and start off by saying I agree with 110% of what the authors have said. I thoroughly endorse it. I'm amazed that these problems have been around for so long and that the industry has been living with them, the lack of equity, the hidden fees, etc. I think it's been quite a disgrace. I haven't mentioned my affiliation, but I might say that I'm a director of an unlisted property fund, which wasn't on the list of named there, but does actually account for about 10% of the industry, so we are a sizable player. We, of course, are not committing any of those abuses because we're only a wholesale fund, and we're owned by our members, as our unit holders own the manager, so we don't fall foul of a lot of those things. But we see our competitors doing all those things, and we see the distortions taking place in the market. There are just three things I'd like to comment on at this point. First of all, the idea of rolling quarterly valuations, I agree, it doesn't help very much. We value every property every quarter, and we only issue units just after the valuations have taken place. So it's very easy to do that. It's very easy to treat the fund as closed for 3 months and you only price it once every 3 months, and then that's when you issue the units. And that totally removes that inequity. It's very simple. I don't see why the industry doesn't adopt that as a standard. I know they want to have their unlisted funds on platforms, but I don't see why they can't hold the money in cash and just just enter the fund once every 3 months after the valuation has been done. I think we're the only ones who do who value every property every quarter. And people say it's too expensive. Well, it isn't, because what you do, you appoint a valuer who does an initial valuation and then does a quarterly update for the next 2 years, and the extra cost of that quarterly update is not very much. So it's not a significant cost. It does create minor problems in that we find the major changes to valuations occur when we change valuers. Valuers tend to be sticky with their views, and you ask two valuers to value the same property, you can easily get a 5% difference. I'm told, and I hope I know this is being recorded, but one of the major property players that got in trouble recently was reputed to do its valuations by ringing up four valuers and finding out which one gave the highest figure, and they got the job. I can't mention which name, but that apparently is a practice that has occurred in the industry, or is rumoured to have occurred in the industry. Certainly when you change valuers, you can get a change in cap rates, and valuers tend to be quite sticky. When cap rates are moving, when the market's going up, valuers are always a bit sceptical. They want to see the evidence, and so the changes in cap rates lag the market. Similarly, we're in a position now where the market may be falling, but there are people saying in the market that cap rates on secondary shopping centres may have gone up 50 or 100 basis points, but so far I think most valuers are reluctant to move them up more than 25 or 50 at the most. So there is a lag, and even if you do get regular valuations, you've still got to put up with that. Buy-sell spreads. Clearly the buy-sell spread ought to be more than 5%. Anyone operating a product with a buy-sell spread of less than 5% is being quite inequitable between its generations of members. I've been on about that in our organisation for a while, and so far I've lost the argument. The reason I've lost is because our investors are very stable, and so there's very little. They all maintain their percentages. Every new issue of units, everyone participates, and so the actual inequity, while it exists, is in practice very small, but it is a serious issue, and we're looking at it again for about the 10th time, and I think we'll move to a buy-sell spread. But in doing that, we're looking at what all our competitors are doing, and I don't think anyone's got more than 3% buy-sell spread. So clearly the marketing departments are winning. I think this is the area where ASIC ought to come in, and so if ASIC has made plenty of pronouncements on buy-sell spreads, so why don't they just say, well, the buy-sell spread has to be realistic? At the moment, they're just staying silent on the issue. Finally, the other point I wanted to make was on all those hidden fees. I think it's a disclosure issue. The fact is, they're getting through the research houses, they're getting through the asset consultants, who are not, I don't believe they're knowledgeable enough to realise how much profit is hidden into some of those fees. There have been arrangements made where listed trusts have shifted some of their assets into an unlisted trust, and in the process created a management fee stream for themselves. That management fee stream then gets capped at a PE of maybe 20. In the meantime, they haven't altered the valuation of the property. It seems to me that smoke and mirrors is creating value out of thin air. Again, one of the major property trusts that got into trouble had been doing a lot of that, and that fictitious value that had been created is now having to be found from somewhere, and they can't find it. So I don't suppose there are many actuaries involved in these research houses these days, but certainly the standards that the research houses are adopting, the way they're presenting the overall fee structure of the trust, is certainly below par. I think there's an area where actuaries could get involved. I've said enough for now. Lots more I could say, but I'll let someone else have a go. Thanks.
Mike, before you go, though, just can I ask you a question? One of the discussion points that Wade Nanny put up was a little question with an implication. Why is it that in the listed property funds you see a 26% negative return over the last 12 months, and in the direct property index a positive 9.2%? The implication is that cap rates are sticky on direct property, unlisted property, and the market is ruthlessly quick on listed investments?
The direct property funds in the main have not adjusted to higher cap rates yet. We've started to adjust, and because we value every quarter, we're seeing some increases in cap rates coming through, but most direct funds haven't done any valuations since the trouble hit. So I agree that we're still showing a 12-month gain of more than 8%, but that's made up of some gains last June quarter, plus some development gains that have come through. But certainly the last quarter, we're starting to see pressure on cap rates. As far as the listed trusts are concerned, you have to recognise that the listed trusts, first of all, contain a lot of gearing, which has hurt them. Secondly, a large part of they were selling at a long way above asset backing, and that extra was this value of their management rights, etc. So they were a large component of the share price of a listed property trust was fund manager value rather than property value. That fund manager value has been slashed. And thirdly, a number of them had overseas assets which have been hurt by currency and by the fact that overseas markets have performed badly. The UK has a property futures market which is reflecting about a 30% drop in value from the peak last year to December next December. So a UK shopping centre has fallen in value by about 30%. So, and if you couple that with the currency, sterling's fallen about 10% against the Aussie. So that's hurt some of the listed trusts. But I think the most important issue is that management take there. I tried to value one listed trust on the basis of its asset backing plus a figure for the management revenue. I just couldn't make it. The overall value was about twice the NAV, and the management rights were on a RP of about 50. I mean, there was a bubble.
Thank you very much, Mark. It's very interesting. Yes, thank you.
Chris Condon, I apologise for being late in, so if you covered this earlier on, then my apologies again. I wonder if you could comment. I see there being a very unhealthy confluence of the following issues. First of all, increase in use of alternatives in strategies and in diversified funds, which have all these sorts of features. By themselves, fine, but coupled with other things such as leverage, both inside the alternative vehicles and also in the strategies as well, and externally leveraged, coupled with also in the superannuation world, the requirement for choice and being able to liquidate and get out of within, I think it's a 30-day period. That's right, isn't it? Did you talk about this earlier on? No?
Not specifically.
Okay, well, you can bring it up. And then shorting inside a lot of these vehicles. Many of these things which make the owner of these investments in a very weak position, particularly then, on almost every dimension. Any observations on that?
Sure. The there is a whole spectrum of funds. Some of the funds aren't geared at all. So maybe we're sort of showing the worst case right through this presentation, but that was intentional. In regards to gearing, a lot of these funds are 100% geared, or whatever you call it. Basically, for every dollar of equity, there's another dollar of borrowing. And that certainly, exacerbates a lot of the issues we've seen. As for the short selling and things like that, it's not something that we've really been looking at. Our main issues have really focused on sort of what we've covered today.
And choice,
yes. As far as I'm aware, I'm not an expert on this, but as far as I'm aware, it's a 30-day for portability, and a lot of managers interpret that to mean that monthly is not good enough because some months are 31 days, and so there's been a real push to weekly pricing and weekly transactional ability. And especially when you get to weekly, it's just really inviting the investor to come and go as they please. When the spreads are so low, you know, a lot of these funds have spreads of 1% or 2%. I think, as you said before, just completely non-realistic. It really is just encouraging people to just move in and out of these as they please. I think in terms of a lot of the messages we had here, I think Annie mentioned it, the closed funds, the funds that have only fixed windows of transaction, you know, we're certainly not referring to those. What we're referring to here is the funds that their number one goal was to get on the platform, and they would really jam the square peg as hard as they could into the round hole to make sure they made that platform. Because with all the super flows, they really saw that as the key. The other thing that compounds the problem is that the massive inflows get this situation that some of them start with seeded assets from a listed trust, or some of them actually will start from scratch, and you're rapidly growing. So issues we've talked about in regards to transaction costs get exacerbated by the fact that some of these funds are going from 100 million to 300 million over 12 months. And so any issues to do with equity and transactional costs, you know, really get highlighted there. And one other issue we saw with fees, and just a little anecdote, was that we actually saw a fund that was in the seeding stage, only had a very small amount of investor money, and there were so many fees actually in the structure that the unit price actually would have been negative. So it's a bit unrealistic.
Well, before we go on to the next question, just quickly, Wade, there was a suggestion, I think, by Chris that maybe member choice had gone too far, which seems to align with this second last bullet point that you put up. Can you explain what that's meant to indicate?
Yeah, sure. I guess what we're just trying to put a different spin on it, saying, well, you know, there is a place for illiquid assets and there is a place for these type of investments, but maybe the problem is the legislation. Superannuation encourages, you know, this mentality of the customer, and what we're saying is maybe superannuation should change and actually require investors, require them to commit. Investors are used to term deposits. They know they lock their money away for 5 years and that's it. So why aren't they required to commit or be allow them to themselves to commit to come into a product like this?
Thanks, Mike.
Yes. Mike Murphy, who knows nothing about the property industry, which I'll demonstrate by being very interested about the concept of cap rates, but don't actually know what they are. I'm guessing capitalisation rates, and I'm guessing they should change because of interest rate changes. Is that pretty close to the mark? The quarterly valuations and the concept of value of property valuations, and in particular the concept of you can have four valuations and pick them in various pick which one you like. At the end of the day, they're pretty much based on underlying assumptions, aren't they, about interest rates, ongoing rentals, vacancy rates, cap rates, and whatever. And given what is the issue with actually documenting a valuation which is based on these various underlying assumptions, and then actually assessing on a weekly or monthly basis how those assumptions have changed, which generates automatically a change in property valuation? That's just a thought. I'm sure there are some real practical issues, and better minds than I have put their minds to it, but it would seem that that would be one approach which sort of could be adopted. And the other comment on the fees and the disclosure templates, Capital Works management fee, surely if that's a regular ongoing fee, that must be in the annualised MER or the ongoing management fee. And apparently you can get out of it in some way, shape or form. That seems potentially a clear breach which ASIC should be jumping up and down on. And similarly, the acquisition and termination costs seem that they should have to be into the buy-sell spreads. How can acquisition and termination costs not actually be in the buy-sell spread sides of things? That's from a simpleton in the superannuation area dealing in more regular or other products where these things, and as a trustee of a fund where we're actively looking both at our unit pricing and at our buy-sell spreads and at our MERs and the disclosure of all of that, it strikes me as interesting in the extreme. And I'll make one last comment on the superannuation liquidity issues. I'm not exactly sure what the rules are, but on the assumption there's a 30-day requirement, I'm reasonably certain that there is, in fact, the provision for, at a fund level, to identify illiquid investments and actually have specified rules around the investments that they actually hold. The issue, perhaps, is more on the product issuers and the salespeople not wanting to enforce such possibilities.
Yeah, I think the issue there, you've hit it right on the head. They don't want to be classified as illiquid. They want to be classified as a liquid investment, so that's where that comes in. In regards to the asset valuations, just quickly, you talked about having models and revisiting those models. You know, those models do exist and they are used. I think the issue comes down to the fact that what it would require would... The RE would need to make a call and say, we are going to override an independent valuation from 9 months ago with our own valuation from our own internal model. And I think personally that you know, the RE just feels that's too much of a risk. So rather than do what I would consider to be equitable, they sort of take the conservative option and just, well, the next valuation's only in 3 or 6 months, we'll just wait for that. I think there's a bit of you know, sort of reluctance to overwrite a valuation like that.
Yes, thank you. We've had the 5-minute warning, so there's probably time for one further speaker after the speaker.
Thanks, Michael Dermody from KPMG. Thanks for the presentation. I agree with those points, Annie and Wade, and I think you're right. They're actually issues that, from my observation, the industry isn't managing very well. I was going to talk a couple of points on transaction spreads, a couple of points on valuation. I might just pick up on the valuation one first, given that's what was recently discussed, in regards to just the last point on the RE, feeling a reluctance there to change the valuation. I guess what we've said to companies who are running these unlisted property trusts is that the asset valuation should be unbiased. So that's sort of the starting point, is that the asset valuation should be unbiased. And then in regards to Mike's point then, the real thing is, what is the process that you go through, given that you don't want to do independent valuations all the time, and then you've got how much does the RE want to get involved frequently as well, about how do you try and make sure that it's unbiased. There were points made about retirees having too much time on their hands and monitoring where property markets are going, and maths teachers are another ones that fall in that category. Our fund managers tend to underestimate the ability of individuals to arbitrage against them. A lot of the time they don't even realise they are being arbitraged against. So I think every time they issue a price, it should be unbiased. It might not be spot on. There still might be jumps when a really rigorous valuation is done, but it should be unbiased. Just on the transaction spread points, agree with all of those. I think Mike's right. I haven't seen a single fund that's got a transaction spread of more than 3%. A lot of them at 1.5%. Abacus was going to be gutsy and go to a 10 or 12% spread, and decided that it wouldn't do it. And they are those sort of competitive issues coming through. That you just simply will not be able to sell any units if you've got a large spread. And I think just on that, a lot of the funds are very different. They've got different inflows and outflows, the ability to net transactions. So the transaction spread might not be as high as that. Not all the funds charge asset acquisition or disposal fees. So... You know, there are some issues there in terms of these funds can be quite different. Some of them run a liquidity facility, which means that the manager is actually buying back the units, so you're not transacting, you're not creating or destroying units, you're just transacting them back to the manager. I think the key point on transaction spreads is that it's actually quite bad, because the managers aren't even doing what they say they're going to do. So a lot of the PDSs will say, well, we're going to base our transaction spread on an average of the costs of buying the assets that are underlying the fund, and there's just not even an ability to demonstrate, again, like the asset valuation side, a process, not to be able to demonstrate the process that they've gone through to be able to show that. Okay, so I think we'll end the comments I had. So thanks very much, Wade and Annie.
Thanks, Michael. Wade, we probably have run out of time now. Wade, do you want to make a final comment?
You might ask where all this is going to go. One thing that is happening is the IFSA Unit Pricing Working Group is looking at this, and it's early days, but there's talk of maybe preparing an IFSA positional paper on the topic. The one issue is that only some of these managers are actually members of IFSA, and so those standards, once you talk about managers that aren't a member of that industry group, there's no binding requirements on them. I guess the other thing that might happen is regulator intervention. But it's certainly becoming higher on everyone's radar, and I encourage that.
Well, thank you, Wade and Addy, for a most interesting and indeed disturbing in some ways presentation. And please join with me as I present each of Annie and Wade with a little gift. Thank you very much.